Welcome to Today on Broadway for Memorial Day, Monday, May 29th, 2017. I'm Broadway World's Matt Tamanini. Before we get started, everyone at Broadway Radio would like to express our sincerest of thanks to the men and women who have and are defending our country, especially those who have made the ultimate sacrifice in giving their lives. We also want to thank the families of past and present service members, as their sacrifices are just as vital. So whatever you are doing today, take a moment to remember the people who have given so much for our freedom. Okay, as I told you on Friday, today's show features an interview I did with actor and writer Ron Fassler. Though Ron grew up in New York, he made his career primarily as an actor in Hollywood, appearing on TV shows like Alien Nation, Sisters, NYPD Blue, and many, many more. You should see the credits this guy has. He has also appeared in numerous films, and he was a writer on Murphy Brown. In the early 80s, Ron also appeared as an understudy on Broadway in both Censored Scenes from King Kong and The Slab Boys, where he understudied the likes of Val Kilmer, Sean Penn, Jackie Earle Haley, Kevin Bacon, Chris Sarandon, and more. Most recently, Ron has returned to writing with his new book, Up in the Cheap Seats, a historical memoir of Broadway. The concept for this book is fantastic, and I loved it from the moment that I heard the pitch. For 2 years, a preteen Ron traveled into Manhattan and saw Broadway shows almost exclusively by himself every single weekend, and from there, he wrote meticulous and wonderful reviews. His new book mixes in a handful of those reviews with conversations with some of the figures that feature prominently in the shows featured, like Hal Prince, James Earl Jones, Mike Nichols, Stephen Sondheim, and more. In total, Ron did 100 interviews for the book, and we talk about many of them in the interview. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation.
I've been addicted to this week on Broadway for years. In fact, I only moved back to New York, my hometown,
right,
about a year and a half ago, and I lived in L.A. And I used to walk my dog and listen to This Week on Broadway. You know, that was like a religious thing for me. Do you know?
That's perfect.
And sometimes I'd hear my name brought up by either Peter or Michael, which was always fun. And
do you know either of them?
I know them both very well. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha.
And I was actually on the broadcast once when Ken Howard passed away, who was a very dear friend of mine. And so they wanted a little bit of info. Yeah. So,
One of the things that when I first heard about the book and first got a press release, what, you know, the pitch is, well, this guy who's turned into an actor went and saw Broadway shows and wrote reviews, and it's kind of adorable. And it's, you know, this cute little thing to look back at the shows. Then when you get into the book, it's so much more than that. I mean, I think that's a great idea for a book because it's, you know, always fun to kind of look back at what precocious things kids write. But there's so much more to this book than just those original reviews. So I kind of want to talk about the reviews themselves, how you got there, and then putting together by talking to all these fantastic people. But I want to start at the thing that just really struck me as somebody who... I have a list of every show that I can ever remember seeing in my life. And, you know, I have the details. So I understand the desire to make a list of everything. But is that something from a very young age that you did exclusive of going to the theater? Or was it something that was a part of everything in your life?
A part of everything in my life. I think I call myself an inveterate list maker in the book. I love the ritual. I used to do it with movies. I used to really be into baseball and baseball cards, baseball stats. You know, so I'm good at that. And I do have something of a photographic memory. Like if you named a year of the Academy Awards pre like 19 like 80, I can't do anything from 80 beyond. But in the olden days, I had a book, and I know that book by heart, so I can picture 1938. I see the picture of Spencer Tracy. I see that he won for Boys Town. And I see that the other nominees were Paul Muni and Gary Cooper. And, you know, I can just do that. And so it's nice that I'm finally doing something with just not trivia, but my devotion to theater history. So yeah. I'm very happy that the book spoke to you both as the documentation of my time going to the theater, as well as its oral history of Broadway. And that's... Yeah. Something about the book that I think is unique, is a selling point. It's a hybrid. I really don't know another book quite like it that marries the two. It's a memoir and an oral history of Broadway. You see, people were telling me early on, they would read chapters and go, the theater history is great. Your interviews are amazing. The stories are great. But Ron, more you. You don't understand how invested we become in that little boy. And if I'm reading chapter 6 and we're 4 pages in and I've lost that thread of the little boy, you better bring him back. And I really paid heed to that. And I think that's what you're responding to. You're telling me that the book was emotional to you, which thrills me. Really does.
Well, who was that little boy? I mean, you know, I know the story about, well, I'm going to do a little tangent here. You mentioned, you know, you were a baseball fan. I found a lot of connection to your admiration of Robert Preston into how I kind of fell in love with my favorite athlete of all time, where you kind of just happened to be taken to see the Music Man and fell in love with him. When I was a kid collecting baseball cards, like you said, I said, you know what? I'm 8 years old. I need a favorite baseball player. I went through and, you know, counted how many cards I had of each player, and I found that Cal Ripken, I had the most cards of Cal Ripken. So I ended up becoming a huge Cal Ripken fan, and much like you say in the book, you just happened to stumble across Robert Preston as an actor's actor, one of the best, someone who's respected. I felt that because I kind of just happened to stumble across Cal Ripken, who was in a lot of ways very similar.
You picked a great hero, not Pete Rose, right?
I'm from Ohio, so there's always a fondness for Pete Rose, but you're right.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And you know, you're reminding me of a story I should have put in the book, because I did follow one baseball player, but the reason is hilarious. I like yours better. mine was that my brother and I both got a package of socks that my mother brought home, and there was an 8x10 glossy in my brother's package of socks and mine. His was Willie McCovey, and mine was Rocky Colavito.
Oh. Okay.
So I hung that photo of Rocky Colavito up in my room, and I'm laughing because I'm remembering this. I forgot it. It's amazing what comes up out of the bowels of our memories, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, anyway, back to, I got off on my tangent, but who was this 11-year-old? Yeah, who was that 11-year-old? If, you know, like I responded to and these people responded to, you know, they wanted to hear more about this boy's journey, but who were you as that child? What were you like? I mean, that's such a crazy adventure to go on so many times, going into the city by yourself. That had to take somebody, especially during that time when the city probably wasn't as safe as it is now.
It was not.
Who were you?
I was a very precocious child. I was a very bright child, but I was also on my own. I was raised in a family of 6 children, and it really was hard to get my parents' attention. You know, my father worked 9 to 5. I only saw him at dinner because then he went out every night. I don't write about this in the book. My father was a gambling addict. He used to go to the racetrack. He used to go and play cards. But basically, it was to get away from my mom and us. I mean, it was awful.
Wow.
I didn't know it was awful at the time. I thought that's what every dad did. You know, they had their own private lives. And you were raised by your mom. My mom did everything. She was a one woman, you know, whirlwind. I mean, she mowed the lawn. My father didn't do anything except bring home a paycheck. And so I had to figure out ways to entertain myself and also ways to get attention. I think becoming an actor was a way to get myself noticed, not only by my parents, because they were forced to come see me in all those plays, although getting a compliment out of them was really hard. Even when I became a professional actor, you know, I'd be on a show like, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air or, you know, L.A. Law or something like that. And, you know, they wouldn't call. They'd probably tell all their friends how great I was. But it would never dawn on them to say, hey, good job last night. They just wasn't in there, whatever. So I had to figure out ways. And, you know, listen, how many actors do you know that became actors because they were just seeking something outside themselves? Why else would you want to pretend to be somebody else, right?
Yeah.
But in terms of how could an 11-year-old suddenly have the wherewithal to decide that I could both afford and physically, you know, get the permission and have the chutzpah to go into New York every single weekend for 4 years. And as I say in the book, even some days where I saw a matinee and an evening show and the out from, you know, noon till 11 p.m. at 12. Crazy, isn't it?
What
an education
really is.
I got.
Yeah.
What an education. And an education not afforded to kids today. First of all, I was self-funded. I was able to do it all without any allowance from my parents. I never got a dime from my parents. And how many kids today can make money at 12 like I did with a paper route? And then again, how in the world do you afford to go to Broadway shows? Because, you know, I could do it on a crazy budget of $10 or $12 a week because the ticket prices were everywhere from $2 to $4, average price of $3.
Yeah, it's hard enough for someone working a 40-hour week job to afford to go to a Broadway show once a month, let alone every weekend and two on matinee days.
Well, again, I was fortunate. I was lucky. I took advantage of a situation, and I've reaped the benefits. I learned about acting by observing, maybe by osmosis, and I also learned how to forge my own opinions. I saw many, many of these shows in previews because often I like to grab a discounted preview. Your audience might be interested to know there used to be this thing where they would offer the orchestra for $5, the front mezz for $4, and the balcony for $3. And I rarely splurged and went, hey, I think I'll sit in the orchestra. I was perfectly content to be in those last two or three rows of a theater and save the $2. Mm-hmm. But I was able to see these shows and, again, have no critics to sway me prior to my walking into the theater. So I was able to say, hey, I think Pearly is going to be a big hit and Melba Moore and Cleveland Little are going to win the Tony Awards. That's one I remember right off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, and that's what I was, I was so kind of taken by, where whether or not, your reviews ended up lining up with whoever their critic was from the New York Times is kind of neither here nor there. But I was so kind of fascinated with just how, I don't know if opinionated is the right word, but how precise maybe is the right word. The reviews, kind of seem to be you're a kid, don't necessarily have the same education that a professional critic does, but whether or not they ended up being the critical consensus or not, they always seem to have a really distinct perspective, which I thought was kind of fascinating, because if I think about 10, 11, 12-year-old kids that I know now, I doubt that many of them would be able to do that for anything, let alone a Broadway show.
Well, thank you for that. That's a good observation. I saved my mother, I should say, saved everything. And I have these, I used to love books. I mean, I read books voraciously. And I have all these book reviews I wrote when I was about like 8 and 9 for school. And every single review ends the same way. I liked the book because it was funny. I liked the book because it was funny. So I definitely graduated from that simplistic approach to critiquing things. And I was definitely influenced by reading reviews. There's no question that what I was trying to do was be as erudite as, the great masters like Brooks Atkinson or George G. Mason, right? But there I was, 12 years old. One of my favorite lines I had that ended one of my reviews was a Joan Rivers comedy called Fun City that she wrote. And at the end I wrote, Fun City tries to be topical, but it is only typical and predictable. And, Ron Fassler, CBS News, good night. I mean, it was like one of those, And then, of course, writing reviews for things like Harold Pinter plays, which were going clear over my head, are absolutely hilarious. I did a book event last night in New Jersey. I had Priscilla Lopez as my special guest because she happens to live in Montclair, which is where I had the reading at a lovely, lovely mom and pop bookstore. And I read aloud my review of Old Times, which was a Pinter play I saw when I was 14. And, I sound like I'm on a rant because I'm so angry. I claim to have walked out of that production. I don't have a memory of doing that, but if it says I did, that's what I did. Because basically I said, when you come back after an intermission, you want to know what happens. But in a Pinter play, you know nothing's ever going to happen. So why stay? So why go?
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, the book I only reproduce a few reviews in the book, but as you well know, I wrote 200 of them.
Yeah.
And that's the only way I know I saw 200 plays in 4 years, is because I have those reviews. I can go right to play 171 and play 47 and take a look at the review. It's incredible.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love kind of the photos of the reviews that you include in some of the chapters, because I mean, it really shows you that this was very structured, very organized, and the ticket prices is so cool to see. But you mentioned, obviously, You had Priscilla Lopez as a guest last night, and that ties really well into the book. You know, because of your career as an actor, whether you knew some of these people before or you had connections to them, you were able to kind of bring in some of the people who maybe were even involved with some of the shows, or at least were around right. in the theatrical community at the time. And one, I know one of the ones that was really important to you, one of the shows and then one of the conversations you had was with 1776. You know, you talk about that being such a big thing, and then you got to talk with William right. Daniels, and you worked with him a little
exactly.
bit. How did you go about when you said, this is how I want to do this book, or this is, I'm going to do a book, this is how I want to do it, I want to talk to some people. How did you start kind of figure out first who you wanted to talk to, and then getting them all on board to talk about certain shows or certain eras or things like that?
Well, you know, it's so amazing that you, out of 100 people interviewed, you just pulled William Daniels out of your hat, because
that's one of my favorites.
That was my very first interview.
Yeah.
And it was very significant because he meant so much to me, because 1776 has a chapter all its own in my book called
right.
The Obsession, because it's the one show I paid more times to see than any other. And I did have a personal connection to him. We weren't friends or anything like that, but I was able to reach out to him, and he said, sure. And I met him, and over the course of almost 2 hours, I realized when it was over that I had the ability to conduct a professional interview. I'd never done one. And the reason why I decided to start the process of interviewing people from that era is because I didn't think I could sell the book solely on my story, because, okay, I've been an actor, some people know who I am, but I'm not a name. And I thought, if I could say on the cover of the book, featuring conversations with William Daniels, Bette Midler, James Earl Jones, Mike Nichols, I could help sell the book. So it was purely on that level that I decided to do it. It ended up enhancing the book, you know, tenfold. But I really had practically no one turn me down.
Wow.
No one said, no, I'm not interested in talking to you. Really, no one.
When you get some pretty impressive people.
Very impressive people. And, you know, I can't begin to tell you what it meant. But when I met Harold Prince, not only was it the first time that I was ever speaking to the man, it was the first time I ever laid eyes on him. I don't know how this happened. I've never seen him in a restaurant. I've never been at the theater the same night as he has. It was kind of remarkable. It was like meeting a movie star. Most people don't get the chance to, you know, be in a room, you know, with Sidney Poitier. And there I was in a room with Harold Prince. And the next day I woke up and I went, did that really happen? I actually thought I might have dreamt it, because it was so important for me to meet an icon like that, an idol. As for Mike Nichols, who invited me graciously into his home, and we were supposed to talk for 30 minutes and talk for an hour, that was based on a personal connection. I had worked with him, and I reached out to him, and he could not have been more gracious. And as it turned out, I don't know this for a fact, I may have been his last interview, because it was very shortly thereafter he took ill. I never expected him to be the first one to pass away from the 100 people I spoke with. But in the 4 years it took me to write the book, seven people passed away.
Oh, my goodness.
So I was so grateful to have interviews with Ken Howard, with John McMartin, with Elizabeth Wilson, with Dick Latessa, with Mike Nichols. Mm-hmm. It means the world to me. So I'm so happy now people are reading it. I mean, that even makes it all the more important. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned, you know, you talked at the beginning that, you know, we had Broadway Radio had you on when Ken Howard passed away, and it obviously ties in with what we were talking about with 1776. Can you just talk a little bit about maybe your relationship with him, but then also the fact that he was kind of attached with this thing that you loved so much as a child?
Well, it's kind of extraordinary. 1776 is the gift that keeps on giving. I met Ken Howard casually through friends, and then we became good friends. And when it came time for me to write the book and we started talking and I was interviewing him, sort of professionally interviewing him, he said to me, Ron, I don't know why I haven't thought of this earlier, but you're the person to help me write my autobiography. And so Ken and I, for about 2 years, had many, many sessions. I have all the tapes. And I even started one particular chapter, and then he died. And I don't think the book will ever get written, only because without him to promote it, I don't think there might be an audience for it, which is sad, because he's got some amazing stories. And maybe I'll figure out some way to do it. I've been in discussions with his widow, who's a dear friend. But you have to understand, I mean, there this play was that I was obsessed with. And then you come 40 years later, I know William Daniels. I know Ken Howard. For the book, I got a chance to meet Peter Hunt, the director. Mm-hmm. Well, Peter Hunt called me right after my interview. I'd actually finally gotten phone reception because he lives at the top of a mountain in Los Angeles. And when I hit the bottom of the hill, he called and said, you need to come back. We're not finished. And after our third session together, he said, I want you to help me write my autobiography. And instead, we've been collaborating on a one-man play for him to perform. And I'm in the process of writing it right now. So and I'm going to not only write it, but I'm going to direct commit it. Now, so think about this for a minute. This little kid at 12 years old goes to see 1776, and 40 years later, I'm directing the director. It's extraordinary.
Who won a Tony?
The youngest person to win the Tony for best director of a musical ever. No one's ever topped it. He had just turned 30 years old.
That's fantastic. I mean, that's almost your history with 1776 and the people involved is almost a show or a book in itself. I mean, that's
pretty
fantastic.
Well, and you read the chapter. You read the ending of my chapter in the book where William Daniels winds up sitting next to me when I attended the Encores production in a theater of 2,500 people last March. I sit down in my seat and William Daniels is sitting next to me.
That's fantastic.
It's just unbelievable. Yeah. And it keeps on giving. It keeps on going because I was in LA 2 weeks ago to do a book launch. And a couple of hours beforehand, I said, gee, I'm hungry. And I decided, you know, I'm going to go to that restaurant where I met William Daniels 4 years earlier. I said, this is going to be a perfect full circle moment. I'll just have lunch at the restaurant. I walk in, Matt, and the maitre d' seats me next to William Daniels.
No. I don't believe you. That you're making that up. There's no possible way.
You have to believe me. You have to believe me. And I was holding the book in my hand, and I said, I'm doing a book launch today. And he said, we just got your book. I said, I know. I sent it.
That's amazing. That's incredible.
Yeah, my life in the theater has been charmed. Both as an actor, but even more so as an audience member. And that's another thing. It really is. The original title of the book was A View from the Cheap Seats. That's the perspective. That's where I'm telling my stories. And it continues to this day, except I don't sit in the cheap seats anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's what I was going to say, is that you started this and you said you had those 200 shows in that course of time in your life. Do you still, after you go see something, do you make a little note somewhere? Do you write a little review or anything like that to keep it going?
I don't. And not only that, and your audience may scream, I don't even keep playbills because I'm not a clutter guy. And also, the playbills are all available online. You can read it. And now maybe I'll regret it, you know, in another 20 years when I want to look at the ads for, you know, old computers.
Right? Yeah, that's funny, yeah. Uh-huh.
The playbills from this era when I saw the 200 shows from 69 to 73, I adore those playbills. They're sacrosanct. I would never get rid of them. I love looking at the ads for, you know, Silvathins, cigarettes, and all that. But today, I don't make any lists. I don't write reviews. I mean, I do a blog, and occasionally I'll critique a show. But the blogs are mostly my sort of theater history columns. I'm not interested in being a critic. I'm really not. I mean, I'm opinionated, but I'm not interested in being a critic. And I love the fact the book is now giving me cachet as a theater historian, as someone who knows a lot about the theater and can spin a good yarn. I'm doing speaking engagements, and some wonderful things are coming from the book right now, which thrill me no end.
No, absolutely. That's fantastic. Well, a couple real quick questions before we wrap up. Do you have a favorite review that you wrote? Either maybe the... Maybe not the show itself, because I'm assuming 1776 is up there, but I mean, do you have just the review itself that sticks out as being one that you're either proud of or just think is funny in retrospect?
Well, so many of them really are funny, and I include a few in the book. But I think one that I kind of really adore is based on something that Ted Chapin, the wonderful head of the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization. Yes, he asked me, and he loves to ask us of people who went to the theater at a young age, when did you first realize that, oh boy, wait a minute, maybe they're not all going to be so terrific? right? So I didn't have an answer to that question for Ted when I sat there. I couldn't remember because I liked everything when I was first going, right?
Yeah.
So I went back and opened up my reviews, and I went through the first eight, which were all raves, and then I got to play number 9, and it was George M., starring Joel Grey, which was a musical about George M. Cohen.
Yeah.
So this is what I wrote in my review. Tisk, tisk, tisk. That's all I can say. My hopes were up high, and they fell faster than a bird with no wings. I'm working with metaphor there. It's kind of blunt, but it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I say the show never gets off the ground. The second after you walk out, you won't remember what you've seen. It ain't no Hello Dolly. It's my last one.
Well, what really is Hello Dolly?
Exactly. Now listen, for your audience, this is my favorite one line, my favorite one word review. I called Hello Dolly gripping.
I can think of a lot of ways to describe Hello Dolly, but I don't know that that's it.
Well, who knows? I might say that after I've seen this new Bette Midler production. Yeah, it may be gripping for all we know. But yes, isn't that hilarious? Gripping. I just love it.
That's so good. Well, I wanted to mention, because I don't know in some of the other interviews or stuff that I've seen you do, I don't know that I've heard you talk about it much, but is actually the illustrations in the book. I know that, they're fantastic. I mean, we always see these things at Sardi's and all these portraits and stuff, but these are even above and beyond that. Can you talk a little bit about those?
They are. Jeff York is an illustrator who spent his entire career in advertising. And only recently has he chucked it and decided it's time to get these out in the world. And I'm hoping that through the book, I can start getting him recognized. I think his work is extraordinary because not only does he have a Hirschfeld-esque quality, but he has Hirschfeld wit. He has his wit, and he's so smart. And if any of your listeners just want to Google Jeff York, you can go to his website and take a look. He really has an extraordinary eye and ear, a tone that he captures. He does movies, he does theater, and he's even available to, you can hire him. You can have your portrait done by him. I'm really hoping that this helps him take off in this respect. And I was just thrilled that he agreed. And may I be honest, I mean, I didn't have to say to him, no, you got to go back to the drawing board. Every one of those illustrations he did, the 9 illustrations he did for the book, were dead on, dead on. I couldn't believe what he was able to come up. The only thing he did was the portrait of me, which serves as the back jacket flap for my author's photo. He has me sitting in a theater seat with a playbill, and the original sketch he gave me, the playbill was The Lion King, and I went, Jeff, you know, with all due respect to The Lion King, it doesn't mean anything to me. He goes, I'll change it to Hamilton. I went, sold.
I love it. I'm looking at it now. Yeah, that's great. Is seat F8 any meaning or importance there? Or was that just a random thing he picked?
I almost asked him to change it to G112, which is the first seat I ever sat in. I probably should have, but I didn't want to make him do any extra work.
Well, that's fantastic.
And of course,
this is great.
How do I know it was G112? Not only did I write it down in those play reviews, but I kept all my ticket stubs.
Yeah,
the cover of the book. Those are my ticket stubs.
Those are the actual ones.
I have every one of them.
That's fantastic.
Every one of them. In the same little, index card box. And I have, remember they used to give you these little envelopes? You probably don't. You're younger.
Yeah, no, but I remember.
They used to give you these little envelopes that would say Schubert Theater. And it would usually have an ad for American Airlines or for Dinty Moore's or some restaurant or something on them. So I saved one of every one of those envelopes. And inside, I put all the stubs. I scotch taped them to little file cards. And they're in a file card box, the exact same box from 45 years ago. It's sitting, I'm patting it right now on my shelf.
It's a wonder that survived all these years,
it's rusted.
Time. Yeah. I mean,
it's got rust on it. Yeah.
You know, not getting thrown away, not getting, whatever. I mean, that's fantastic.
Well, if you went to my mother's house, you'd see that nothing is thrown away. So that's part of it. I'm very fortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank God for the review.
No, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to do this. This was so much fun, and I got the book a few days ago and have gone through a lot of it, and I'm looking forward to reading it cover to cover, because
please get to the end. I'm proud to say it has some very touching and poignant things to it as well that people are responding to.
Well, Ron, thank you so much. This is great.
Well, if you're ever in New York and you're seeing a show, give me a ring.
I will.
Take you out for a drink.
Sounds good. Right? Thanks so much, Ron.
Thanks,
have a good
Matt.
One. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.